Theykatra podcast conversations for the curious essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Theykatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today we are tackling, well, a real titan of Western philosophy, Immanuel Kant, and his absolutely foundational work, The Critique of Practical Reason. This book really tries to answer that fundamental question: how should we act?
It does more than just answer it, I think. It attempts to completely rebuild ethical philosophy from the ground up. Kant wasn't asking, you know, how do we feel about what's right or wrong? His question was much deeper. What should I, as a thinking, rational being, actually do? And crucially, what's the objective universal reason for doing it?
And that was a really critical question during the Enlightenment, wasn't it? Because thinkers like David Hume, who came before him, had basically landed on the idea that morality is, well, it's about sentiment, human feeling. If something makes us feel good or we sympathize, then it's moral.
Exactly. And Kant saw that as, frankly, a disaster waiting to happen. If morality is just based on shifting feelings or what your culture happens to think or even just what makes you personally happy, well, then morality loses all its universal authority. You end up with subjective moral relativism. And for Kant, that meant the whole idea of human dignity just falls apart.
Right. So Kant sets out on this incredibly ambitious project. He wants to find a basis for morality that's as solid, as unshakable as the laws of physics. He aims to ground ethics not in what we observe or feel, but in something much more fundamental, pure reason itself.
Yeah, the whole point is to secure human freedom and dignity. He wants to prove that our ability to act morally is the ultimate expression of our rationality. So our mission today really is to unpack how he does that. How does Kant actually establish a moral law that he thinks applies to every single rational being, no matter who they are or where they live?
Okay, let's start with the man himself. Immanuel Kant, 1724 to 1804. He's really the central figure of the German Enlightenment, known for being incredibly systematic, very precise, and famously he spent almost his entire life in just one city, Königsberg in Prussia.
He did. And he completely shifted the direction of philosophy with what he called his Copernican Revolution.
Yeah.
You know, instead of assuming our minds just conform to the world out there, he flipped it. He asked, how must the world conform to the basic structures of our own minds?
And the Critique of Practical Reason we're discussing today, that's the second part of his huge philosophical system, right? He'd already laid out the limits of what we can know through pure reason, like theoretically, in his first critique. Things like God, freedom, the soul. He argued we couldn't have scientific knowledge of those.
That's absolutely key context. Kant saw that Hume's skepticism about what we can know had led people to be skeptical about morality, too. If reason can't give us certainty about those big metaphysical ideas, then how can it give us certainty about right and wrong?
So what does he do? He makes this brilliant move. He says, okay, maybe we can't know things like God or freedom in a scientific sense, but we have to postulate them. We have to assume they're real as necessary conditions for our moral lives to even make sense.
Exactly. It's a reversal. It's our moral experience that actually gives us a kind of rational basis for believing in these things, not the other way around. He's using reason not just to understand the world, but fundamentally to legislate how we ought to live in it. It makes him such a unique figure in trying to ground ethics so systematically in reason.
Okay, let's dive into the book itself then. The core idea, it's pretty revolutionary. Kant insists that morality has to have a pure a priori basis, meaning it has to be totally independent of experience, of what happens in the world, the moral value of an action. It lies completely in the maxim, the principle or rule that motivates you, not in the consequences.
Right. That focus on the maxim, the principle behind the action, that's everything for Kant. Because think about it. We often can't control the outcomes of our actions, can we? A really well-intentioned act might accidentally cause harm, and sometimes, unfortunately, a bad action might luckily lead to a good result. If morality depended on that kind of external luck, it wouldn't really be moral in his view.
So the book takes you on this journey. It's definitely demanding, but it has this incredible logical structure. He starts with what you might call the destruction phase. He goes through all the traditional ways people tried to ground ethics, and basically he dismantles them one by one.
Yeah, he looks at things like basing morality on achieving happiness or pleasure or self-interest, or even on following specific interpretations of God's will. And he argues they all fail. Why? Because they're all conditional. They all depend on something else, something subjective. What makes me happy isn't necessarily what makes you happy. A truly universal moral law can't just shift around based on individual desires or circumstances.
Okay, so once he's cleared away all those contingent foundations, he moves to the construction phase. And this is where he brings in the absolute core of his ethical system, the categorical imperative. This is the absolute unconditional command of reason that defines what's morally right.
And here's the really empowering part, I think. Kant argues that the very moment we become aware of this universal moral law operating within us, he calls it the fact of reason, that awareness immediately reveals our own freedom. Because if we know we ought to follow this law, it logically implies that we can follow it. It establishes us as autonomous self-governing agents.
Let's look more closely at this law then. How does he structure it? He makes this key distinction between maxims, which are like our personal subjective rules, I will always tell the truth, or I will exercise 3 times a week, and practical laws, which have to be objective, universal principles applying to everyone.
And the critical thing about the categorical imperative is its absolute nature. You know, most of the rules we follow in life are what he calls hypothetical imperatives. They're conditional. They take the form. If you want to achieve goal X, then you must do action Y. Like, if you want to pass the exam, then you must study. The must only applies if you want the goal.
Right. The obligation depends on the desire.
Exactly. But the categorical imperative is completely different. It's just do Y, period, unconditional, no ifs attached. For Kant, genuine moral laws must have this absolute necessary form demanded by reason itself.
And this leads straight to the famous test, the first formulation. Act so that the maxim of your will could always hold at the same time as a principle of a universal law.
Let's break that down. It's a test of universalizability. It's not asking what will happen if I do this. It's asking, could I rationally want everyone to adopt the principle I'm acting on right now?
Okay, give us an example, like the lying promise.
The classic example. Suppose I need money, and I consider making a promise to repay it, even though I know I can't. My maxim, my personal rule, is something like, it's okay for me to make a false promise when it gets me out of a tight spot. Now, Kant says, universalize that. Imagine a world where everyone operates on that principle.
Well, the whole idea of promising would just collapse, wouldn't it? No one would trust any promise.
Precisely. The very institution of promising becomes logically incoherent if everyone adopts that maxim. Therefore, I cannot rationally will that my maxim become a universal law. It leads to a contradiction. So, the action made in the false promise is morally forbidden. It's a test of logical consistency, not consequences.
Okay, that focus on the maxim, not the outcome, it forces a huge shift in thinking, right? This idea of the primacy of law over the good. Most ethical systems before Kant tended to define what's good first, like happiness or flourishing, and then figure out rules to achieve it. Kant completely flips that.
He flips it entirely. For Kant, the moral law comes first. It's the moral law itself that determines what counts as good. And this leads him to the concept of the goodwill. He famously says the goodwill is the only thing in the world, or even out of it, that can be considered good without qualification.
Without qualification, why?
Because it's the only thing entirely under our rational control. Our talents, our fortunes, even our happiness, they can be misused or depend on luck. But our intention, our willing to act according to a moral maxim, that can be pure, regardless of whether our actions actually succeed or fail in the world.
Okay, but here's where I, and I think many people, stumble a bit. Kant insists the only truly morally worthy action is one done purely from duty, just because the law requires it, completely separate from feelings. That feels, well, incredibly cold. If I jump into a river to save someone drowning, not because I'm thinking about duty, but because I feel overwhelming compassion, Kant seems to say that action, while good, lacks true moral worth. Isn't that just counterintuitive?
It definitely sounds counterintuitive at first glance, I agree. But we need to be really precise about what Kant means by moral worth. He's not saying acting from compassion is bad. It's a beautiful, commendable thing to do. He'd call that acting from inclination, or what he sometimes terms pathological feeling, meaning it's based on our passive emotional state. It's still a good action.
But not morally worthy in his specific sense.
Not in the highest sense, no. For Kant, the unique moral worth that defines us as rational, autonomous agents comes only when we act because the moral law commands it, especially when it might go against our feelings or inclinations. It's about the purity of the motive, grounded in reason alone.
Okay. So if it's not based on these warm feelings like compassion or sympathy, how are we actually motivated to follow this seemingly abstract moral law? What makes us do it?
Ah, that's where Kant introduces this unique feeling he calls Respektachtung in German. He argues this is the only truly moral incentive. It's not an ordinary emotion like pity or love, which sort of happened to us. Respect, for Kant, is a feeling produced by reason itself when it recognizes the supreme authority and majesty of the moral law. It's a sense of awe, maybe even a kind of rational humiliation, that silences our selfish desires and acknowledges something higher.
So this respect for the law, that connects to respecting other people too.
Absolutely. That reverence for the rational capacity within ourselves and others is precisely what grounds the second famous formulation of the categorical imperative. Act in such a way that you treat humanity, whether in your own person or in the person of any other, always at the same time as an end, never merely as a means. That respects the foundation of human dignity. We can't just use people as tools.
Right, the ends in themselves principle. Okay, now moving into the part he calls the dialectic. He identifies a kind of paradox, right?
Yes, a rational contradiction, or antinomy, as he calls it. Our practical reason, our moral sense, naturally strives for what he terms the highest good, the summum bonum. This would be a state where perfect virtue, being morally good, is perfectly united with happiness, having all our desires satisfied. Reason tells us these should go together.
But the problem is, in the real world, they often don't. We see good, virtuous people suffer, and sometimes, frankly, wicked people seem to prosper. There's this mismatch. Our sense of justice, our reason, finds this deeply unsatisfying. It demands this apparent contradiction be resolved somehow.
Exactly. And this is where Kant's system takes, well, a really bold leap. Since our theoretical reason, the kind we use for science, can't prove that virtue and happiness will ultimately align, our practical reason, our moral reason, takes charge. It essentially forces us out of moral necessity to postulate certain truths. We have to assume they are real to make the whole moral enterprise coherent and not just, well, absurd.
Wait, so if reason hits a wall scientifically, Kant basically says moral reason gets to step in and say, okay, for morality to work, we must believe these things. That sounds like a huge philosophical move, almost like faith dictated by duty.
It is a huge move, but he argues it's a rational requirement, demanded by morality itself. For morality not to be a cruel cosmic joke, we need these postulates. The first one is the immortality of the soul. The moral law demands perfect virtue, but achieving that seems like an infinite task, something we can only approach over time. So Kant argues we must postulate an infinitely enduring existence to make that moral perfection possible.
Okay, immortality for the sake of virtue. What's the second?
The existence of God. Since the moral law itself doesn't guarantee that being virtuous will make you happy in this life, we need to postulate a supreme, rational, and moral being God who has the power and the will to eventually ensure that happiness is distributed in exact proportion to virtue. This guarantees a just cosmos in the long run.
Right. God is the guarantor that justice ultimately prevails. Yeah. And the third postulate?
The third is freedom. And Kant calls this the absolute keystone of his entire system. How do we know we're free? Because we are directly conscious of the moral law, the fact of reason. We know we ought to act morally. And that ought, he argues, directly implies can. Our awareness of moral obligation is the immediate evidence of our freedom to choose to follow it or not. Freedom is known through the moral law.
So, boiling this all down, what's the big takeaway for someone trying to grasp Kant? For me, it really seems to be this powerful idea of the autonomy of the will. We aren't just subject to moral rules handed down from somewhere else. Our own reason is the author, the legislator of the moral law. We give the law to ourselves.
That's absolutely central. And this autonomy, this self-legislation, is the ultimate source of our dignity. It's the opposite of what he calls heteronomy, which is when your will is determined by something outside your own reason. Maybe the desire for reward, fear of punishment, social pressure, or even just a strong emotion or physical urge.
So if I decide rationally to stick to a diet because I value my long-term health, that's autonomy. But if I only stick to it because my doctor scared me, or because I want someone specific to be attracted to me, that's heteronomy. My will is being driven by external factors.
That's a great way to put it, yes. And this ties directly into why acting with duty for duty's sake is so important for Kant. The moral purity, the real worth of an action, lies only in doing it out of respect for the rational law itself, not because it feels good, or achieves some other desirable outcome.
And we also talked about the fact of reason, the factum der vernunft. This is his claim that we just have this immediate, undeniable awareness of our moral obligations. It's like an innate moral compass, the bedrock starting point for his whole ethical system. You can't really argue it away, he thinks.
Right. And the consequence of all this is what you might call a rational foundation for faith. It's a complete reversal of the traditional view. Instead of starting with God dictating morality, Kant ends up arguing that our moral reason leads us to rationally postulate God, freedom, and immortality because they're necessary for morality to be fully coherent.
Okay, this book is famously dense, but it also contains some incredibly powerful and almost poetic lines that really stick with you. Let's share a couple that capture the essence of his thought. Probably the most famous, the one that sums up his awe for both the external and internal worlds. Two things fill the mind with ever new and increasing admiration and awe: the starry heavens above me and the moral law within me.
Yeah, that line is just stunning. It perfectly juxtaposes the vast, seemingly deterministic order of the physical universe with the equally awe-inspiring, free, rational, moral order that exists within the human mind. It's a profound reflection on our unique place.
And then there's the ethical core, the basis for human rights. Act in such a way that you treat humanity, whether in your own person or in the person of any other, always at the same time as an end, never merely as a means.
That's the formulation that emphasizes intrinsic worth. Every rational being has dignity, value in themselves. You simply cannot treat another person or yourself, for that matter, merely as an instrument, a tool to get what you want. Their rational agency must be respected.
And finally, that simple but powerful connection between obligation and capacity. Ought implies can.
It sounds simple, but it's profound. If reason tells you that you have a moral duty to do something, then it necessarily follows that you possess the freedom and the ability required to actually do it. Otherwise, the ought would be meaningless.
So these aren't just abstract philosophical points. They have real-world bite, don't they?
Absolutely. Think about professional ethics. That ends, not means, principle is incredibly relevant. Consider a manager who pushes employees to the point of burnout just to hit quarterly profit targets. Kant would say they are treating those employees merely as a means to an end profit. That violates their dignity. The question should always be, am I acting on a principle I could universalize while respecting everyone's rational agency? Or impersonal decision making. That universalization test is a really practical tool. You know, when you're tempted to cut a corner, maybe fudge something small on your expenses or taxes, ask yourself, could I rationally will that everyone act this way? If the system would collapse, if trust would erode completely, then the action is morally off limits, even if you think you don't get caught.
And it scales up to social and political life, too. You can see Kant's ethics as providing a philosophical foundation for concepts like universal human rights, justice, and even democracy. The idea is that any just system must be built on respecting the rational autonomy and inherent dignity of every single individual. The state can't just treat people as cogs in a machine. So wrapping up, what's the final big takeaway?
For me, the real aha moment with Kant is understanding that duty isn't meant to be this grim burden. It's actually the expression of our highest freedom. We are most truly free, most fully ourselves as rational beings, not when we're slaves to our impulses, but when we choose to act according to the moral law we legislate for ourselves through reason. That's actually a very empowering vision.
I completely agree. Kant leaves us with this incredibly profound and, in its own way, optimistic view. Morality isn't something imposed from outside. It's internal. It's rational. And this gives us a source of self-worth that's incredibly resilient because it's based entirely on our own moral integrity, on our commitment to acting rationally and respecting the dignity of ourselves and others, regardless of external success or failure. It's a powerful counterargument to the kind of moral relativism that says anything goes.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acantra Foundation.